Chapter 32. Men, like planets, have both a visible and an invisible history. The astronomer threads the darkness with strict deduction, accounting so for every visible arc in the wanderer's orbit, and the narrator of human actions, if he did his work with the same completeness, would have to thread the hidden pathways of feeling and thought which lead up to every moment of action, and to those moments of intense suffering which take the quality of action like the cry of Prometheus, whose chained anguish seems a greater energy than the sea and sky he invokes, and the deity he defies. Deronda's circumstances, indeed, had been exceptional. One moment had been burned into his life as its chief epoch, a moment full of July sunshine, and large pink roses shedding their last petals on a grassy court enclosed on three sides by a Gothic cloister. Imagine him in such a scene. A boy of 13, stretched prone on the grass, where it was in shadow, his curly head propped on his arms over a book, while his tutor, also reading, sat on a camp stool under shelter. Deronda's book was Sismondi's History of the Italian Republics. The lad had a passion for history, eager to know how time had been filled up since the flood, and how things were carried on in the dull periods. Suddenly he let down his left arm and looked at his tutor, saying in purest boyish tones, "Mr. Fraser, how was it that the popes and cardinals always had so many nephews?" The tutor, an able young Scotchman, who acted as Sir Hugo Malinger's secretary, roused rather unwillingly from his political economy, answered with the clear-cut emphatic chant which makes a truth doubly telling in Scotch utterance, "Their own children were called nephews." "Why?" said Deronda. "It was just for the propriety of the thing, because, as you know very well, priests don't marry, and the children were illegitimate." Mr. Fraser, thrusting out his lower lip and making his chant of the last word the more emphatic for a little impatience at being interrupted, had already turned his eyes on his book again, while Deronda, as if something had stung him, started up in a sitting attitude with his back to the tutor. He had always called Sir Hugo Malinger his uncle, and when it once occurred to him to ask about his father and mother, the baronet had answered, "You lost your father and mother when you were quite a little one. That is why I take care of you." Daniel, then straining to discern something in that early twilight, had a dim sense of having been kissed very much, and surrounded by thin, cloudy, scented drapery, till his ringers caught in something hard, which hurt him, and he began to cry. Every other memory he had was of the little world in which he still lived. And at that time he did not mind about learning more, for he was too fond of Sir Hugo to be sorry for the loss of unknown parents. Life was very delightful to the lad, with an uncle who was always indulgent and cheerful, a fine man in the bright noon of life, whom Daniel thought absolutely perfect, and whose place was one of the finest in England, at once historical, romantic, and homelike. A picturesque architectural outgrowth from an abbey, which had still remnants of the old monastic trunk. Diplo lay in another county, and was a comparatively landless place which had come into the family from a rich lawyer on the female side who wore the peruke of the Restoration. Whereas the Malingers had the grant of Monk's Topping under Henry VIII, and ages before had held the neighboring lands of King's Topping, tracing indeed their origin to a certain Hugh Glumalinger, who came in with the Conqueror, and also apparently with a sickly complexion which had been happily corrected in his descendants. Two rows of these descendants, direct and collateral, females of the male line, and males of the female, looked down in the gallery over the cloisters on the nephew Daniel as he walked there. Men in armor with pointed beards and arched eyebrows, pinched ladies in hoops and ruffs with no face to speak of, grave-looking men in black velvet and stuffed hips, and fair, frightened women holding little boys by the hand, smiling politicians in magnificent perukes, and ladies of the prize animal kind, with rosebud mouths and full eyelids, according to Lely, then a generation whose faces were revised and embellished in the taste of Kneller, and so on through refined editions of the family types in the time of Reynolds and Romney, till the line ended with Sir Hugo and his younger brother Henley. This last had married Miss Grandcourt, and taken her name along with her estates, thus making a junction between two equally old families, impaling the three Saracens' heads proper and three Besants of the one with the tower, and Falcon's Argent of the other, and, as it happened, uniting their highest advantages in the prospects of that Henley Malinger Grandcourt who is at present more of an acquaintance to us than either Sir Hugo or his nephew Daniel Deronda. In Sir Hugo's youthful portrait with rolled collar and high cravat, Sir Thomas Lawrence had done justice to the agreeable alacrity of expression and sanguine temperament still, to be seen in the original, but had done something more than justice in slightly lengthening the nose, which was in reality shorter than might have been expected in a Malinger. Happily the appropriate nose of the family reappeared in his younger brother, and was to be seen in all its refined regularity in his nephew Malinger Grandcourt. But in the nephew Daniel Deronda the family faces of various types, seen on the walls of the gallery, found no reflex. Still he was handsomer than any of them, and when he was 13 might have served as model for any painter who wanted to image the most memorable of boys. You could hardly have seen his face thoroughly meeting yours without believing that human creatures had done nobly in times past, and might do more nobly in time to come. The finest childlike faces have this consecrating power, and make us shudder anew at all the grossness, and basely wrought griefs of the world, lest they should enter here and defile. But at this moment on the grass among the rose petals, Daniel Deronda was making a first acquaintance with those griefs. A new idea had entered his mind, and was beginning to change the aspect of his habitual feelings as happy careless voyagers are changed with the sky suddenly threatened, and the thought of danger arises. He sat perfectly still with his back to the tutor, while his face expressed rapid inward transition. The deep blush, which had come when he first started up, gradually subsided. But his features kept that indescribable look of subdued activity which often accompanies a new mental survey of familiar facts. He had not lived with other boys, and his mind showed the same blending of child's ignorance with surprising knowledge which is oftener seen in bright girls. Having read Shakespeare as well as a great deal of history, he could have talked with the wisdom of a bookish child about men who were born out of wedlock, and were held unfortunate in consequence, being under disadvantages which required them to be a sort of heroes, if they were to work themselves up to an equal standing with their legally born brothers. But he had never brought such knowledge into any association with his own lot, which had been too easy for him ever to think about it until this moment, when there had darted into his mind with the magic of quick comparison, the possibility that here was the secret of his own birth, and that the man whom he called uncle was really his father. Some children, even younger than Daniel, have known the first arrival of care, like an ominous irremovable guest in their tender lives, on the discovery that their parents, whom they had imagined able to buy everything, were poor and in hard money troubles. Daniel felt the presence of a new guest who seemed to come with an enigmatic veiled face, and to carry dimly conjectured, dreaded revelations. The ardor which he had given to the imaginary world in his books suddenly rushed toward his own history, and spent its pictorial energy there, explaining what he knew, representing the unknown. The uncle whom he loved very dearly took the aspect of a father who held secrets about him who had done him a wrong, yes, a wrong. And what had become of his mother, for whom he must have been taken away. Secrets about which he, Daniel, could never inquire. For to speak, or to be spoken to about these new thoughts seemed like falling flakes of fire to his imagination. Those who have known an impassioned childhood will understand this dread of utterance about any shame connected with their parents. The impetuous advent of new images took possession of him with the force of fact for the first time told, and left him no immediate power for the reflection that he might be trembling at a fiction of his own. the terrible sense of collision between a strong rush of feeling and the dread of its betrayal, found relief at length in big slow tears, which fell without restraint until the voice of Mr. Fraser was heard saying, "Daniel, do you see that you are sitting on the bent pages of your book?" Daniel immediately moved the book without turning round, and after holding it before him for an instant, rose with it, and walked away into the open grounds, where he could dry his tears unobserved. The first shock of suggestion passed, he could remember that he had no certainty how things really had been, and that he had been making conjectures about his own history, as he had often made stories about Pericles or Columbus, just to fill up the blanks before they became famous. Only there came back certain facts which had an obstinate reality, almost like the fragments of a bridge, telling you unmistakably how the arches lay. And again there came a mood in which his conjecture seemed like a doubt of religion, to be banished as an offense, and a mean prying after what he was not meant to know, for there was hardly a delicacy of feeling this lad was not capable of. But the summing up of all his fluctuating experience at this epoch was that a secret impression had come to him which had given him something like a new sense in relation to all the elements of his life. And the idea that others probably knew things concerning which they did not choose to mention set up in him a premature reserve which helped to intensify his inward experience. His ears opened now to words which before that July day would have passed by him unnoted, and round every trivial incident which imagination could connect with his suspicions, a newly roused set of feelings were ready to cluster themselves. One such incident a month later wrought itself deeply into his life. Daniel had not only one of those thrilling boy voices which seem to bring an idyllic heaven and earth before our eyes, but a fine musical instinct, and had early made out accompaniments for himself on the piano, while he sang from memory. Since then he had had some teaching, and Sir Hugo, who delighted in the boy, used to ask for his music in the presence of guests. One morning after he had been singing We'd Echo before a small party of gentlemen whom the rain had kept in the house, the baronet, passing from a smiling remark to his next neighbor, said, "Come here, Dan." The boy came forward with unusual reluctance. He wore an embroidered holland blouse which set off the rich coloring of his head and throat, and the resistant gravity about his mouth and eyes as he was being smiled upon, made their beauty the more impressive. Everyone was admiring him. "What do you say to being a great singer? Should you like to be adored by the world, and take the house by storm, like Mario and Tamberlik?" Daniel reddened instantaneously, but there was a just perceptible interval before he answered with angry decision, "No, I should hate it." "Well, well, well," said Sir Hugo, with surprised kindliness intended to be soothing. But Daniel turned away quickly, left the room, and going to his own chamber threw himself on the broad windowsill, which was a favorite retreat of his, when he had nothing particular to do. Here he could see the rain gradually subsiding with gleams through the parting clouds which lit up a great reach of the park, where the old oaks stood apart from each other, and the bordering wood was pierced with a green glade which met the eastern sky. This was a scene which had always been part of his home, part of the dignified ease which had been a matter of course in his life. And his ardent, clinging nature had appropriated it all with affection. He knew a great deal of what it was to be a gentleman by inheritance, and without thinking much about himself, for he was a boy of active perceptions, and easily forgot his own existence in that of Robert Bruce, he had never supposed that he could be shut out from such a lot, or have a very different part in the world from that of the uncle who petted him. It is possible, though not greatly believed in at present, to be fond of poverty, and take it for a bride, to prefer scour deal, red quarries and whitewash for one's private surroundings, to delight in no splendor, but what has open doors for the whole nation, and to glory in having no privileges except such as nature insists on. And noblemen have been known to run away from elaborate ease and the option of idleness, that they might bind themselves for small pay to hard-handed labor. But Daniel's tastes were altogether in keeping with his nurture. His disposition was one in which everyday scenes and habits beget not envy or rebellion, but delight, affection, aptitudes. And now the lad had been stung to the quick by the idea that his uncle, perhaps his father, thought of a career for him which was totally unlike his own, and which he knew very well was not thought of among possible destinations for the sons of English gentlemen. He had often stayed in London with Sir Hugo, who to indulge the boy's ear had carried him to the opera, to hear the great tenors, so that the image of a singer taking the house by storm was very vivid to him. But now, spite of his musical gift, he set himself bitterly against the notion of being dressed up to sing before all those fine people, who would not care about him except as a wonderful toy. That Sir Hugo should have thought of him in that position for a moment seemed to Daniel an unmistakable proof that there was something about his birth which threw him out from the class of gentlemen to which the baronet belonged. Would it ever be mentioned to him? Would the time come when his uncle would tell him everything? He shrank from the prospect. In his imagination he preferred ignorance. If his father had been wicked, Daniel inwardly used strong words, for he was feeling the injury done him as a maimed boy feels the crushed limb which for others is merely reckoned in an average of accidents. If his father had done any wrong, he wished it might never be spoken of to him. It was already a cutting thought that such knowledge might be in other minds. Was it in Mr. Fraser's? Probably not, else he would not have spoken in that way about the Pope's nephews. Daniel fancied, as older people do, that everyone else's consciousness was as active as his own on a matter which was vital to him. Did Turvey the valet know? And old Mrs. French the housekeeper? And Banks the bailiff, with whom he had ridden about the farms on his pony? And now there came back the recollection of a day some years before when he was drinking Mrs. Banks' whey, and Banks said to his wife with a wink and a cunning laugh, "He features the mother, eh?" At that time little Daniel had merely thought that Banks made a silly face, as the common farming men often did, laughing at what was not laughable, and he rather resented being winked at and talked of, as if he did not understand everything. But now that small incident became information. It was to be reasoned on. How could he be like his mother, and not like his father? His mother must have been a Malinger, if Sir Hugo were his uncle. But no. His father might have been Sir Hugo's brother, and have changed his name, as Mr. Henley Malinger did, when he married Miss Grandcourt. But then, why had he never heard Sir Hugo speak of his brother Deronda, as he spoke of his brother Grandcourt? Daniel had never before cared about the family tree, only about that ancestor who had killed three Saracens in one encounter. But now his mind turned to a cabinet of estate maps in the library, where he had once seen an illuminated parchment hanging out that Sir Hugo said was the family tree. The phrase was new and odd to him. He was a little fellow then, hardly more than half his present age, and he gave it no precise meaning. He knew more now, and wished that he could examine that parchment. He imagined that the cabinet was always locked, and longed to try it. But here he checked himself. He might be seen. And he would never bring himself near even a silent admission of the sore that had opened in him. It is in such experiences of a boy or girlhood, while elders are debating whether most education lies in science or literature, that the main lines of character are often laid down. If Daniel had been of a less ardently affectionate nature, the reserve about himself and the supposition that others had something to his disadvantage in their minds might have turned into a hard, proud antagonism. But inborn lovingness was strong enough to keep itself level with resentment. There was hardly any creature in his habitual world that he was not fond of, teasing them occasionally, of course all except his uncle, or unc, as Sir Hugo had taught him to say, for the baronet was the reverse of a straight-laced man, and left his dignity to take care of itself. Him Daniel loved in that deep-rooted filial way which makes children always the happier for being in the same room with father or mother, though their occupations may be quite apart. Sir Hugo's watch chain and seals, his handwriting, his mode of smoking, and of talking to his dogs and horses, had all a rightness and charm about them to the boy which went along with the happiness of morning and breakfast time. That Sir Hugo had always been a Whig, made Tories and Radicals equally opponents of the truest and best, and the books he had written were all seen under the same consecration of loving belief which differenced what was his from what was not his, in spite of general resemblance. Those writings were various, from volumes of travel in the brilliant style, to articles on things in general, and pamphlets on political crises, but to Daniel they were alike in having an unquestionable rightness by which other people's information could be tested. Who cannot imagine the bitterness of a first suspicion that something in this object of complete love was not quite right? Children demand that their heroes should be fleckless, and easily believe them so. Perhaps a first discovery to the contrary is hardly a less revolutionary shock to a passionate child than the threatened downfall of habitual beliefs which makes the world seem to totter for us in mature life. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.